the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Today, OSU student Anna M. Peterson will describe her research on abortion in the United States and abroad, and she'll be talking to Origins Associate Editor Patrick Patiandi. Then, my guest is Thurber House author Tracy Chevalier, the author of The Girl with a Pearl Earring, an international bestseller a few years back. She will be at the Thurber House on May 21st discussing her work with The Girl with the Pearl Earring, as well as their latest book, The Last Runaway, about Quakers and the anti-slavery movement in the United States. So stay tuned.
Welcome to Writers Talk History, a partnership between the magazine Origins from the Ohio State History Department and the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing, also at Ohio State. All Origins articles and podcasts can be accessed for free online at origins.osu.edu and at writerstalk.org. I'm your host, Patrick Patiandi, and our guest today is OSU historian Anna Peterson, who specializes in comparative women's and European history. Anna joins us today from Oslo, Norway, where she's been conducting research. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Thanks.
So your article for Origins covers abortion in the United States and Europe, and you titled it, quote, "From Commonplace to Controversial," which is very interesting phrasing. Why that title?
I chose that title because I think it really gets across the point that abortion used to be quite commonplace. It took place in society with little kind of legislative repercussions. But at some point in time, namely, you know, the 19th century, the state did become interested in legislating this, and it became also, therefore, a culturally controversial topic.
Interesting. And in your piece, you note a much longer history to this issue than the mere 40 years that Roe v. Wade has been around. What's important to remember about this larger background?
I think that Roe v. Wade is an important moment in this larger history of abortion, but that the focus on Roe v. Wade really becomes a focus on legalization. And so a lot of Americans thought Roe v. Wade, okay, abortion became legal then. And then that's kind of prevents them from thinking about the fact that, well, it wasn't always illegal. So I wanted to take us back, you know, a few hundred years and look at the time when abortion was commonplace, was legally practiced in both the United States and Western Europe. And what, you know, really led to the illegalization of abortion. And then, of course, the processes that took place in order for it to become re-legalized, like with Roe versus Wade in the United States.
Great. You mentioned the difference between Europe and the United States. And given your research, what are some of the historical reasons women in some countries have better access to abortion services and birth control than in other countries?
Abortion scholars typically think about this question in terms of an abortion triad. So the relationship between women, medical practitioners, mainly doctors, and governmental officials or the state apparatus. And depending on the balance between these three actors, you have different types of abortion policy. Well, as a historian, I would say that the balance between these actors are historically contingent. Right. So if you have moments where the state is more willing to listen to women or women's organizations, or moments where medicine and therefore doctors have greater power, you're going to see a different alliance then between doctors and the state. And so there's a lot of things that come into play, but I would say, you know, a lot of historically contingent things, like I talk about in the article, such as the Great Depression, so economic crisis, can alter the relationship between these actors. Moments where feminism is quite strong, so in the 1960s and 70s, you can see a change also in this relationship.
You've mentioned a couple different, this triad, as you've described it, and I'm wondering about a specific case that's been in the news lately. Abortion in Ireland has recently been in the news because of its strict abortion laws. The Economist magazine reports that every year 4,000 Irish women go to Britain to terminate their pregnancies. Is there anything unique about the Irish context?
Well, Ireland certainly has divisive religious politics. And we see from kind of this longer history of abortion that predominantly Catholic countries or countries with kind of stark religious tensions, might be able to include the United States in that group, have more restrictive access to abortion in the 20th century. And Ireland, in particular, is now one of the only countries in Western Europe where abortion is illegal in, if I'm correct, almost all circumstances. The reason I hesitate with that is because Ireland now is considering loosening some of its abortion restrictions because of the backlash that has been occurring, because there have been a number of women who have died because they were not able to get access to legal abortion services in Ireland.
Interesting. And so for those who are maybe more interested in exploring the topic a bit more, is there a book or two that you highly recommend for further reading on the topic?
Yeah, the Origins article online has a bibliography, but I would highlight Dorothy McBride's Abortion in the United States, a reference handbook, which is exactly what it is. It's a reference handbook, and it's a really good place to start. It not only explores abortion in the United States, but she also does have some comparative chapters where she looks at other places, including Europe. I think that she also looks at South America as well. And then if you want to really go in depth at abortion or the history of abortion in the United States, Leslie Reagan's When Abortion Was a Crime is really a classic and a very interesting read.
And do you think both those books can have a good effect if people are interested in forming or learning more about general American public policy, do you think?
Yes, I think so. Abortion cuts across a lot of different policy issues, including social policy, reproductive policy, and healthcare policy. And so I think that looking at this particular issue of abortion, we're able to get a much kind of more complex understanding of policy development in certain places.
That's great. And I think really kind of draws out the use of, you know, historical analysis for these sorts of issues. And so your article for Origins on abortion laws in the US and Europe is directed at a broad audience. Given the difficult nature of the topic, were you at all nervous about writing a piece for the general reader?
Yes. Abortion is a difficult topic. It's a complex topic. It's a very controversial topic, like the title of my article implies. And I was taking on quite a long period of time and this comparative aspect. So I was nervous about condensing such a complex topic into something that the average reader wouldn't be bored with.
Right.
And I knew that by doing that, I would have to sacrifice some of the complexity and the nuance, which as a historian was difficult to do. And I was also a little bit nervous about the digital format because it is a volatile issue in the United States, and the fact that Origins does allow people to put comments on the articles. So that was something that I was quite nervous about. But it was really nice to be able to write something that I could, or perhaps I should say, it was nice to be able to write something that my mother could or perhaps would want to read.
Definitely. So despite these difficulties that you've referenced, did you still enjoy writing this piece as compared to your academic work? Would you recommend this sort of thing to your colleagues?
I did enjoy writing it. It was certainly a challenge, which was part of the you know, part that made it enjoyable. It caused me to really think and write in a very different way. And I think that that in and of itself is quite rewarding. And so, yes, I would recommend it to my colleagues because I think that it's a really great opportunity to push yourself and think about doing public history, think about what history has to offer for the general audience, and really provide that kind of historical contextualization for a lot of the current debates going on in society.
That's really great. And I'd like to ask you now a little bit about your research. What is it like conducting research in a foreign country? Right now, we know you're in Oslo, Norway.
It's a lot of fun. Oslo, in particular, is perhaps challenging to be here during the winter. It gets very dark very early.
Right.
And it's quite cold. And you have to take into consideration kind of different habits of work. So, for example, Scandinavians have great quality of life. They work a lot less hours than Americans. And then that means that the archives are not open as long. That means that nothing is open on Sundays. That means that most people go home from work at, 3 p.m. So I think that definitely can be challenging, and you really have to think in a different way and adopt a different kind of routine and a mindset. But it's really rewarding to get to interact with people who approach your research problem from a completely different perspective, who have different backgrounds than you're perhaps used to. And that has been immensely beneficial for me.
I'm wondering how traveling abroad and doing research in Oslo, how that might have changed your writing process. Are you writing as you're doing the research, or are you mostly collecting materials? Are you thinking about the process as you're collecting the materials? Give us some reflections on how you're going about that.
I am writing while I'm here, in addition to doing research. I think that that's really, I guess I would say that that's a very smart way to do it, because I'm in, close vicinity of the sources if I need to, go back and look at something in order to keep writing about it. So I tried to do that. And I find that writing while I'm here is also beneficial in the way that I can ask, Norwegians certain questions. So if I'm, in doubt about a way to translate a certain word, I can go and talk to some of my colleagues at the Center for Gender Research at the University of Oslo and say, hey, this Norwegian word, I want to translate it like this, but what do you think? And that's been really helpful to be able to run that stuff past them. It's also been really great because at the center where I'm have an office right now, there's political scientists as well who know quite a bit about legislative process and how to get access to legislative materials. And so I can talk to them about certain problems I'm encountering with parliamentary debates or, laws, and they're able to point me in the right direction that I can then use in the archives. So if I'm coming across those sorts of problems while I'm writing, I have really great resources here that I wouldn't have if I was at OSU.
Definitely. It sounds like some of those contacts that you kind of mentioned earlier have become really helpful for you.
Yes. Invaluable, I would say.
Great. Well, Anna, thank you very much for joining us on Writers Talk History.
Thanks for having me.
That was OSU student Patrick Patiandi, the associate editor of Origins magazine, which can be found online at origins.osu.edu. And he was talking to OSU student Anna M. Peterson about her work as a historian at The Ohio State University. And I encourage you to go look at that website to find out many great articles about history, historians, and work being done at The Ohio State University. And now, my interview with Tracy Chevalier, the author of The Girl with a Pearl Earring, which was an international bestseller. She will be in town on May 21st with the Thurber House Evening with Authors. If you've read that book or her latest, The Last Runaway, you may want to go to see her speak at the Thurber House. The best way to check on that is thurberhouse.org. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Tracy Chevalier.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about your new book, The Last Runaway.
The Last Runaway is about an English Quaker woman named Honor Bright, who is 19 or 20 during the book, and she emigrates to Ohio in 1850, accompanying her sister, who's going to marry somebody in Ohio. And the sister doesn't make it, and Honor is stranded in Ohio not knowing anybody. And eventually, she ends up working on the Underground Railroad. She discovers that there are slaves passing through the state who are trying to get to Canada, and she starts helping them. So the book is about her growth as a person and her learning to put her principles that she practiced in England, or her principles she learned in England, into practice in America.
Since I'm with The Ohio State University, we're always interested in books set here, the 3 to 4 published per millennium that are set in Ohio. So tell me about your time in Ohio, specifically when you were going to school in Oberlin.
I was at Oberlin College as an English major from 1980 to 1984. And I grew up in D.C., Washington, D.C., and but Oberlin was a really good fit for me because it was very progressive. It has that reputation. It's very liberal, has a great English department, and I knew I wanted to be an English major, and it also has a fantastic conservatory. I had been studying clarinet when I was a teenager, and although I didn't go to the conservatory, it was good to have the music around. And I really love my time there. I'm also grateful to it for introducing me to London, because I did the London semester for English majors from Oberlin when I was a junior. And once I was in London, I thought, this is a wonderful city. I want to come back. So I ended up going back after I graduated, and I've been here ever since.
It sounds more than like you were Honor Bright stranded in London. Because Honor Bright was stranded in Ohio, as you described. It sounds like you are sadly stranded in London. That must have been difficult.
Well, one of the things I did in this book was to explore the idea of being the other, being the stranger in a strange land. And because but I did it the opposite direction, as you've pointed out. Honor Bright goes from England to America, and I went from America to England. But in a way, it still gave me an opportunity to explore all the differences between English people and Americans. And when I was researching the book, I read a couple of accounts by quite well-known people, well-known English people, of their time in Ohio and also in the States. One of them was Charles Dickens. He wrote this book called American Notes in 1842. He came over to the States for probably it was the world's first book tour, and he went all over the place, including in Ohio, and he took notes and he published this book, and it's hilarious. I mean, he had quite a tricky time with Americans. I mean, Americans at that time, and I think even now, are very plain speaking, kind of say what they mean. And he describes at one point, he's sitting in a train carriage, I think, and this man comes up and stands in the doorway and just stares at him, doesn't say hello. He says, Americans never seem to say hello. They just look at you. And then he spat his chewing tobacco on the floor and then walked away. And Charles Dickens thought, oh, that's what Americans think of me. And, the other book I read was by Frances Trollope, who is the mother of the writer Anthony Trollope. And in 1828, for reasons known only to herself, she goes to Cincinnati to open a dress shop. And the dress shop didn't do very well, but she kept a journal, which she turned into a book called Domestic Manners of the Americans. It was published in 1832, and it was immediately a sensation. And she's incredibly critical of Americans. She says all sorts of things like the women dress gracelessly. They walk flat-footed. Americans don't seem to be able to have a conversation. They sit there and they don't say anything. They don't know how to ask questions or keep the conversation going. Americans eat too much corn-based food. Americans eat too fast. I just thought it was hilarious. And the funny thing is, I think some of the points she makes still hold true today. One thing she says is that Americans are incredibly proud of their country and very proud of their independence and very, very patriotic, much more so than the English. And I would say that's probably true. I'd also say, in general, it's probably true that Americans eat faster than English people. So I had a lot of fun exploring all of that. And, you know, some of it was based on America in general, and some of it was based more specifically on Ohio.
Okay. Well, this opens up many wonderful opportunities for you to start timing people as they eat in London and then time them when you get here to Columbus on Tuesday, May 21st, when you visit the Thurber House Evenings with Authors series. Tell me about your choice to set the novel in Ohio. You said you did research on it from the British point of view. Why Ohio instead of where you grew up in Washington, D.C. or the East Coast?
Well, I had the idea for the book when I went back to Oberlin a few years ago for a meeting. And I happened to be there when the novelist Toni Morrison was unveiling a bench in Ohio that was commemorating – it was a monument to the Underground Railroad. And it got me thinking about the Underground Railroad, which I had known about before, but I never really thought deeply about it. And I then, a couple days later, went to a Quaker meeting in Washington, D.C. I grew up going to a Quaker camp, and although I'm not a Quaker now, I still go to meetings sometimes. And I was sitting in silence thinking about Quakers and how there was a long tradition of them working as abolitionists and on the Underground Railroad. So I put the two together. And the reason I said it in Ohio was Ohio was probably the busiest, most active state in terms of the Underground Railroad. Because of its geography, Ohio is set between a southern state, Kentucky, which was a slave state, and Lake Erie, which if you cross it, you get to Canada. And that was where a lot of slaves were aiming to get to, because it wasn't enough to go to a northern state. You could still be taken back across the border. So like, you could get into Ohio, but your master or a slave hunter could come and get you and take you back to Kentucky or Virginia or wherever. So a lot of slaves were aiming to get to Sandusky or Cleveland, where they'd take a boat to Canada where they couldn't be touched. And it seemed to me that really made Ohio a very attractive proposition, especially since I lived there for 4 years. And the other thing that I liked about the state at the time is that you have this movement from the south to the north of runaway slaves, and you have also a movement east to west of settlers who were leaving the Northeast Atlantic states to go west, and Ohio was the gateway. So it was a very transient state. And there's something about Ohio, you know, I think it gets really bad press. I don't know why people like to put it down so much, but I find it a really, really interesting state. I think partly because it has its own character. You know, people think of it as a Midwestern state, but I don't think it's a Midwestern state like the way Iowa or Nebraska or Missouri is. And it's not an East Coast state either, not at all. It's really its own character. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why maybe people are a little bit don't know what to make of Ohio, so they like to put it down instead. But I think it's a completely interesting place and a great place to set a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, we agree. And interestingly, I know that there are monuments on the Ohio State University campus to the Underground Railroad as well. Yeah.
I'd come and visit and have a look.
I know there's a plaque on campus that commemorates it, its participation in it. You had mentioned going to a Quaker meeting on your Facebook page, and you say, "We live in a noisy, overstimulated world, and I find an hour of silence a welcome thing." That's a sentiment that you connected with her over, is the silence, the sitting down and quieting of the mind so that, as Honor Bright says, the spirit can make its presence felt.
Yes, I think that we these days, our concentration is so broken up. People are not even being able to sit through a movie anymore without looking at their phones. I was at the cinema the other night and there was somebody looking at their device. And I was thinking, why on earth would you want to do that right now? But it seems that we're having a hard time letting go of all the stimulus. And it's actually a wonderful thing to sit for an hour in silence. It's very, you go deep down, and there are a number of descriptions in the book of Honor doing this herself, of sitting in meeting and sinking down in. They talk about sinking into the silence and finding the peace that lies at the bottom of it.
Now, and Honor says that she has some difficulty with that. That's also true, a sentiment that you experienced, thinking, getting to bring yourself down to that kind of depth of silence.
Yes, I go to Quaker meetings sometimes, and some meetings are more successful for me than others. Sometimes the first probably 20 minutes of meeting, a meeting lasts an hour, and I can feel my mind is just chattering away. I'm thinking about, you know, what am I going to cook for dinner, or, you know, what about that book I was reading, or I didn't run that errand. And the key is to try to let go of all that and to move away from all of that, so that you're almost in a nonverbal state. And sometimes it works and you can do it, and sometimes not. I mean, it's a lot like meditation. It really is. The difference is that you're sitting with other people, and for a Quaker meeting is all about a communal spirit and sitting in silence together, unless you feel moved to speak. And that is, it's incredibly powerful to sit with other people in silence. It's a wonderful thing, very cleansing, I find. But it does, sometimes it works better than others. And for Honor, she was used to going to meeting in her small town in England. And for her, it takes a little while to get used to the new silence of America, the quality of the silence being a little bit different. So it takes her some time to learn how to sink down.
Now, my last question is also comes from the website, and it's your FAQ, a list of 23 questions that no one asks you. So I felt sort of obliged to think about asking you a question. You have number 10, I am happier when there is a cat in my life. And number 11, I always grit my teeth when I pet cats.
It's true.
And this makes me concerned for your dental well-being. How do these go together?
My dentist is not happy with my teeth.
Is he unhappy that you then have cats? Is he prescribing that?
I haven't told him about the gritting my teeth when I pet the cat. If he ever reads my website now, he'll know why I have some of the ends of my teeth are a little bit kind of worn down.
Do you ever, as you're petting the cat, tell the cat through your gritted teeth, this is costing me to be kind to you, cat? Anything?
I think I'm going to go and do that now. I have a tortoiseshell cat named Treacle, and I think I'm going to have to give her a pet and tell her about the dental work I'm going to have done.
You have no idea how expensive this is, Kara. You know, that's a nice way to conclude. Well, Tracy Chevalier, I thank you very much for talking to us today on Writer's Talk. And we look forward to your May 21st Evenings with Authors at the Thurber House.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. For more information about my guests, Tracy Chevalier and Anna M. Peterson, visit www.writerstalk.org. Don't forget to friend us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/writerstalk. You can also follow us on Twitter with our Twitter handle @writerstalk. Until next time, this is Doug Dangler from The Ohio State University. Keep writing.